confront people with a series of dilemmas. Rosita pointed out something that I think should not be overlooked, and that is the persistence of native cultural identity. Wherever I've gone in the villages, people think of themselves as distinct people in Alaska. They haven't adopted the notion that they're assimilated in any way. Even where they don't speak their languages, they still feel they are distinct people. They belong to a village. That village has certain land and ought to keep that land in perpetuity, pass it on from one generation to the next. And people speak often the corporate language. They talk about shares and profits and proxies, but in the end they often wind up saying, look, what I'm really talking about is the land, and I think this land should stay in native hands in perpetuity. And that, it seems to me, is the bottom line. That's where you keep winding up. Well, 44 million acres is still largely in native hands. What's the best way of ensuring that it remains in native hands? Corporate, IRAs, trusts, something else, or a combination of them. I've talked long enough to bring us to 12 noon, and I think this has been a useful introductory discussion. And this afternoon, with your permission, we will talk about, what really will happen in 1991. And if any of you have suggestions about the agenda, please speak to Rosita or David or me, and we can alter it as we go along. So we'll start again at 1:15, if that's okay. Well, I think we might as well start now this afternoon. And the idea this afternoon is that maybe we could look at the outlook after 1991. That is, let us suppose that there are no changes in ANCSA. What will happen? Will people sell? What about the 1980 amendments? Are they helpful? And perhaps we might consider the question whether the corporations, all of them at least, will survive to 1991. I put down John Taylor and Paul Goodwin and Drew Hageman and Gary Anders here on our agenda just because John Taylor says he has a doomsday scenario, and I thought we might as well start off with that. After that, the news is bound to get better, I should think. But all of you feel free to just catch my eye and participate in the discussion as we go along. So, John, we'll turn it over to you now.
Thank you, Tom. Such an introduction. I can go from here. Further down. Really, the whole idea of putting together a scenario
in the future. It's sort of like taking a trip down an uncharted river. You know, when you're going down an uncharted river, which we are in many cases, in fact, that's really what our discussion has been about, what if, it pays often to get out and walk down the bank and peek around the corner and take a look and see how you're going to get there. So I think my purpose today is to add to our roundtable discussion an opportunity to take a peek around a corner, maybe not the corner we want to look around, but a corner that maybe we need to look around just in case. So I'd like to propose a different date for us to focus on. Instead of 1991, why don't we try 2011, 20 years after 1991? And let's make some assumptions. Let's assume that everything that could go wrong went wrong. For example, as we moved into Congress to come to grips with some legislative changes, we found that the assimilationists' mood had not only stayed the same, but maybe increased a little. And it was almost impossible for us to really get any significant legislative changes through without opening up the entire ANCSA legislation to dramatic changes. Along with that, we could almost look at state politics and make some of the same assumptions also. An assumption that as we moved in and tried to change some of our corporate statutes, we found great resistance to changing our corporate statutes for a lot of other reasons other than native corporations. In fact, we're beginning to find today some extreme resistance to some of the proposals in our proposed legislation for other reasons. So let's assume also that our efforts here in the state to make our corporate statutes, particularly our profit corporate statutes, more flexible, really didn't come about very well. Another assumption, that AFN was really incapable, unable, the group as a unit was unable to come to a consensus strong enough to provide a strong enough political base to go forward in the state or Washington and really have the clout it needed to get the job done. For whatever reasons, we were unable to get that consensus back together again. And lastly, here in the state, another assumption that would sort of hold as we look around, before we look around the corner, would be something that's already possibly beginning to happen, and that's the shift of political power in the state from the rural to the urban areas. We could very easily see in 20 years, 25 years from now, that the rural and interior Alaska really has no political clout at all. So let's put that in our assumption also. So given those assumptions, let's take a look at what some variables might look like 20 years after 1991. One, corporate control. 20 years after 1991, year 2011, we've had corporate failures. We've had one, possibly two, regional corporations disappear from the scene, possibly from bankruptcy. Possibly from merger. It's a loss in one way or the other of land. Village corporations, many, many village corporations have disappeared from the scene, either through legislative acts that failed to renew their status as corporations as they failed to file. Many of the village corporations became very lucrative takeover targets. Because they had land assets, many of them in new coming rural or new coming infrastructure areas that they didn't realize but other people did, and they became very quick takeover targets. We had a lot of shifts in mergers and different corporate ways of consolidating between village corporations and corporations. In fact, something that's been talked about many times in the 1980s finally came about between two major regional corporations, and that was a merger of two regional corporations. So there has been some significant shifts in the 20-year period in corporate control and native control of corporate assets in that particular area. One of the other things that is beginning to take place 20 years hence is the loss of the native shareholder base. During the 20-year period from 1971-1991, there's been a steady decline in total number of shareholders across the board. That decline continued for another 5 to 10 years after 1991, and then all of a sudden the shareholder base started increasing as some corporations started going to the market and selling shares. The impact was that the native majority shareholder base in many smaller corporations disappeared very quickly. Two markets have begun to take place in Alaska for native shares. The standard market, brokerage houses, but a unique market, unique to Alaska, but not a unique to stocks. That's sort of a black market for shares. Any aggressive broker, any aggressive buyer or seller, making trips to villages, making trips to the bars, shares were beginning to be bought and sold without control. And those people that had the stockholders lists and corporations daily were opening up mail with new share sale certificates. One of the major shifts that had taken place in the 20-year period, particularly in those corporations that had lost land-based, native-based control, was a shift to income-producing stock philosophies. Back in the 80s, most of the corporations were usually in a growth stock position. But as you begin to analyze what was happening in the year 2000, you begin to notice that a majority, particularly those corporations that had lost their native majority shareholder position, were now in the income stock position, which means they were very aggressive in the use of their assets. The first refusal rights that were proposed back in the 1980s and some corporations adopted were found to be not very useful in most cases. What really happened was most corporations couldn't afford the cash flow to pick up all of the tenders. What most corporations really used that for was to starve off, stave off, to protect themselves against a public offering or a tender offer. And they could only afford to do it maybe once or twice, and they didn't do it to buy all shares. They did it just to buy enough shares to fend off the buy offer. And after they'd done it once, they weren't in a position to do it twice. The land bank really never became widely used. Many small villages opted to go into the land bank just before they collapsed. Some villages completely disappeared from the map. Back in the late 1980s, after the air carriers and the marine cargo carriers were deregulated, there were some dramatic shifts in the logistics patterns in rural Alaska. Consequently, some villages who now had become cash economic dependent were no longer in a viable position to exist as a village and had to move. Those were the few villages that ended up just dropping their land into land development and walking off. Regionals in the 1990s found it increasingly difficult to change their articles of incorporation and their bylaws. Many waited too long, too hesitant, didn't know what the future was going to look like, and so waited until after 1991 to begin to make the shifts that were needed in the articles of incorporation and the bylaws to protect what was now becoming a minority native position. Most of the articles and bylaws had been written to protect the majority position, and as some corporations begin to see the shift coming, they were unable to get a big enough consensus to change the articles. Major changes to the infrastructure of interior Alaska by 2011 had begun to have a very dramatic impact on certain regional areas and the villages in those areas. Bethel, Nome, Kotzebue had all experienced dramatic infrastructure developments. These, coupled with the aggressive positions of some of the regionals in those particular areas, really overwhelmed many of the village corporations in those areas. And so they had some dramatic cash economy problems, television consumption, consumer consumption problems, ideological shift problems. By the year 2011, many of the villages that 20 years before had seen themselves as isolated rural villages were now rural urban villages and didn't realize it. In the long run, in the year 2011, without any changes, we could easily see ourselves reduced to about 6 regional corporations. 2 of them are a merger. The number of village corporations reduced almost to 50%, and most of the land assets of those regional, of those village corporations, is now owned by banks who are selling to developers or are looking at the mining patents and the resource patents on those areas. Now, what this scenario is meant to do is provide us with a look at some possible difficulties, and I'm sure there's a lot more that we can think of, but one of the things that scenario development can do is it can provide sort of a mesh against which all of our ideas about what we need to do, what we can do, what we may have to do can be thrown up against. And so what I'd like to suggest for next several minutes, Tom, if we may, maybe we should add to this scenario just a little bit about what realistic things might happen if some of those assumptions came about and we were unable to make some changes. What do we have to guard against?
Well, there's the good news. Who wants to carry on from there? Drew and then Paul.
Just for a minute, Jack, I think as we look at your challenge, one of the questions I'd ask would be the one of the dynamic issues is the likely or in your doomsday scenario the actual taking over of the nonprofit or the profit regional corporations. Who are what kinds of organizations are the most likely candidates for takeover, and what is the impact that might have on the other regional corporations with their assets no longer in native hands?
Who winds up owning Doyon, et cetera? That's what you're asking.
Who ends up owning it, but who or what kinds of organizations? Maybe it's not Doyon that is hot, is top on the hit list. Maybe it's other kinds of organizations that may be.
I say Doyon is purely for the sake of making it concrete.
Absolutely.
One of the things that we discussed before amongst ourselves at lunch, and something that we just sort of touched on here, is one of the problems with protecting against a takeover that we know from the literature now, and we know from actual experience, is one, an aggressive takeover is an extremely expensive thing to protect against. It's extremely expensive in time. You really have to commit almost your total corporate assets to it for that short period of time that they're really after you. The cash demands on your corporation are extreme during that short period of time. You got to have the cash right then to pay a lot of real quick short-term bills. But lastly, and this is the thing that's going to hurt us the most probably, is it takes a constant effort to adjust, realign, and reevaluate defensive strategies almost on a daily basis. And so what organizations are most vulnerable? Those organizations that don't have those capabilities. So that would lead us to one, village corporations first. Our smaller, less cash-heavy regional corporations. And then the ones that look so obvious, you know, the ones that are cash heavy, resource heavy, probably, you know, the most lucrative looking targets, but also maybe the toughest target to go after. So realistically speaking, I would suspect that our first takeover targets would probably be village corporations.
Village corporations and regional corporations that may not be able to defend themselves very well.
Just one question before we go on. Who, is there any way of predicting, for what it's worth, who would wind up taking them over? Who wants them?
Well, you know, that's a good guess, but I would suspicion that you're going to have resource developing oriented companies. That's really what most of the assets are for. But that doesn't rule out organizations that are looking for cash.
You mean a village corporation that happens to have a bank account with $250,000?
Be very easy to
might be a target if somebody could buy up a majority of shares for $100,000.
Yeah.
Well, Elizabeth had her hand up, Bart, and then.
I just wanted to underline what has already been stressed in the area of the difficulty of dealing with a takeover. When we were trying to take a look at the possible anti-takeover devices, one of the statistics I stumbled across, and this was with very sophisticated corporations who can bring to bear all of the things that John was talking about, who have their plans in place, who are constantly relooking them, who have their staffs ready in case this is ready to go, who can mobilize themselves and respond positively to a takeover offer. Even in those situations, something like 20% only of those corporations survive as separate entities. The others are either taken over by the raider, in other words, it's a successful takeover attempt, or the white knight, the so-called friendly corporation that you turn to for help to help you beat back this offer that you're not wanting to accept. But in either case, if you're talking about only 20% being able through the anti-takeover devices to protect themselves from takeover, and that's with the most sophisticated devices that you can bring to bear, what do you think we're talking about then when we put all of our corporations at risk this way, insofar as you wish to keep native control? I suggest that it isn't a very, as the expression goes, it's not a pretty picture.
Paul Goodwin and then Bart. Would you like to go now, Paul?
I have a little bit different scenario, and not exactly a different scenario. It's just that my time frames are different. I would look rather from now until 1991 and look at a few of the factors that are going on now, but relating to probably the same thing you're saying. In other words, for the most part, if we make the assumptions that you are providing us that indeed, for one reason or another, there are no changes to ANCSA, that for the most part, I would agree with what you were saying. From now until 1991, however, I would point to a few difficulties that may amplify on the assumptions that you were making. First of all, politically in the United States, the population is getting older, for one thing. It is becoming more and more conservative. This is apart from the fact that we have Reagan in Congress, Reagan as a president and so on and so forth. We are becoming a more conservative society. It seems to me that we are becoming more assimilation-oriented, less special interest, quote-unquote, oriented, and so forth. And as a result of factors like that, it is going to become altogether more difficult to get changes to ANCSA than we might have expected, as an example, in the late 60s, early 70s, when all of this happened in the first place. It will become much more difficult, apart from the Reagans and that sort of thing, who are more conservative anyway. As a result of that, I think the assumption that there are going to be no changes, or at least few changes, in ANCSA by the time 1991 rolls around is a fairly good assumption. And as a result of that, just those sorts of considerations, there are corporations that are looking at tender offers right now. They're not waiting until 1991, or they're not going to wait another 2 years just to see if the assumptions are in fact correct. I think that they are believable sorts of statements, and as a result of that, there are corporations that are looking at this possible takeover.
You mean now, corporations outside looking into Alaska?
Looking into Alaska.
Yeah.
A good example of some of the corporations that would be looking at Alaska, generic type corporations, are the large diversified multinationals, as an example. Some of these other topics that are on the agenda. First of all, I hope that, from my point of view, that I've answered the first question, or the first topic, what will happen if there are no changes in ANCSA. I think that that probably the best assumption at this stage of the game is that the changes that will be made will be fairly minor or moderate sorts of changes, and that we are not going to get any dramatic 50-year extensions to 1991 or that sort of thing. I think that they're going to be fairly mild changes that can be accommodated. And then, given that, will the people sell? And then what is the value of the shares? Looking at those two particular items, I think there's a good example in the fairly recent past concerning Mobil Oil Corporation and original tender offer, I believe it was by Seagram's in Canada. A number of larger corporations got into that. What finally came, and there's been a number of mergers here lately anyway, in the recent past, large corporate mergers, some of which have been defended against by the corporation that is to be bought out. It's like you said, the white knights come in. The net result of all of this is that apart from the book value of the stock, the market value is elevated, and then that's what the stock is worth. A typical Alaskan regional corporation may be worth $100 million in terms of book assets. That would be the book value, but without considering the asset value of the land. If there's a particular corporation, multinational, that wants to come in and make a tender offer that elevates that book value, or that elevates in effect that book value up to a very acceptable market value that does include the land or does include consideration of the land, then will people sell? Well, I think a number of them will, because it's going to be an extremely attractive offer, especially if you have a family situation where there's 5 or 6 or 10 or whatever it is in your family, each owning 100 shares, each going for a very attractive dollar amount because of very attractive tender offers or very propitious takeover schemes, by several corporations. In my opinion, I think people will sell when they're faced with that kind of an attractive offer. It may be that they do not wish to alienate their native heritage, but again, it gets down to that heritage, the communal aspect of the act as opposed to the individual aspect of the act. If a very attractive offer is made, there's a number of them that's not going to alienate their native heritage, perhaps, but they'll certainly give up the communal aspect in favor of what they get individually. I think that's just a statement of human nature. It's nothing peculiar to any one particular group. And how all of those considerations, anyway, finally then, relate to the 1980 amendments, the right of first refusal. The thing that I would worry about in that, for instance, let's take it as a personal point of view. is that who is making who is placing the value on that stock? If it's the market that's doing that, okay, fine. Then they can give me then they can give me that right of refusal if I'm just a disinterested stockholder and I just want to sell it, and it's okay that they want to buy it. There's no tender offers going on at that point. What value are they going to place on the stock? I would worry about that. The few other considerations here. I belong to a successful corporation, NANA. I get dividends every year and always have from both the village corporation and the regional corporation. You can tell by looking at me that although I'm part Native, I'm also part white, and I come from a family that is typically that way. The net result in my case came out to be that I'm very individualistic, I'm very non-communal, and that's my emphasis. As a result of that, even though I was raised in Kotzebue, as a result of that, for me, at the way ANCSA is, for the most part, works for me. It works for me. I do not. If I sold my stock in ANCSA, I would not be selling my Native heritage, as an example. Those things would not be sold. I realize, however, that the land is a very important thing for the people. It always has been. That's very traditional, and it has been demonstrated through anthropological literature that for a long time areas have been used by extended family groups, which are largely egalitarian societies, not exactly tribes, they're egalitarian societies, but they had territories. One of the suggestions that could perhaps be made is that the regional corporations can remain the same to satisfy the individualistic aspects of Native Alaskan expectations with ANCSA, but that particularly the village corporations and the land associated with that be somehow protected. And I think that would accommodate something of the two concerns that originated with you, Bart.
Thank you, Paul. That's an interesting suggestion. Claude and then Gary.
I'd like to comment on a couple of the things that you mentioned, and also you, John. It has to relate to the sale of the stock. I think we're talking about two different things. You're talking about individual sale and corporate sale under the gun. They both end up being the same result, but you're looking at two different things. You're looking at the individual sale because of greed, or the corporate sale because of necessity, back taxes, whatever. I can see where the corporate sale under the gun is a potentially dangerous situation, not only for the strong corporations, but more so for the weak corporations, but also the strong corporations. I question, however, the individual sale. I've seen these hearings going across the state and regions meeting about 1991. It's much, much different than 1971, when it was brand new and the corporations were formed. Right now, people are becoming informed. They're learning more and more about what can happen to the things that they fought so hard to get. And it's changed people. People are thinking different. And I have to go back to what Charlie said this morning. Is not only our Native people hardy, but they're proud too. In that respect, the value of the shares is priceless when it comes to the land. It's much easier to sit here in Anchorage and say that there's going to be some people selling, and there probably will be. I don't know. Nobody knows. We'll have to see. But it's easy to do that. But it's much harder when you're at home on the Keokuk River. You got your moose out to thaw for dinner while you're out cutting wood or setting your traps. That's a much, much different situation. And in that respect, the shares represent much, much more than money. And I think because of the meetings that are being held and the things that are happening statewide, that that type of feeling will continue to grow. And hopefully by 1991, I think that all Native people will be proud to say, we don't need to sell, and we'll hope for the best for the corporations, try to support the corporations so that we don't need to sell. I do have a question for you that I don't quite understand. You mentioned broker marketing of shares, and I assume that that's a broker coming in, a licensed broker coming in, picking up the shares, and then attempting to put it on the market. I don't quite understand that, because the marketing of shares relates a lot to their earnings, the growth or income potential, price over earnings ratio, et cetera, on the open market. If such a case were to occur, I would assume that it would be on behalf of an individual corporation, a multinational corporation, and I'm not positive, but I think there might be some laws restricting that type of relationship with a private licensed broker. So if you could expand on that.
Well, I foresee several things happening. Without stricter laws in Alaska, we're going to have many abuses of the private brokering for shares. And I would think that you're also going to have the quiet takeover of people coming in and buying shares quietly, as you pointed out, to begin the takeover. And that's an obvious strategy, particularly in a village corporation. It won't take that many, particularly if you have low participation. But one thing that we have not experienced in this state, as we have as other states have experienced, is, you know, if we look at our state statutes on brokerage, they're very small and rather unsophisticated compared to maybe California, New York State. And so I think that's an area of concern. And so my assumption was, well, let's assume we don't make any sophisticated changes, because let's assume we didn't make them to our corporate statutes also. I would see an awful lot of abuse that would be hard to stop short term.
Well, you're talking, if I might pursue this for a moment, after 1991, people will have the right to sell their shares to their neighbors. Private transaction. I assume that is so. Brokers can buy shares, but they are governed by Alaska's laws relating to the activities of brokers. And you're saying there might be a black market in which brokers would be out in the villages on a weekend trying to pick up a majority of shares by Monday morning. You're nodding in affirmation. I'll just say that for the
Yes, that's correct.
Right. Bart Garber, and then Gary Anders, and then Roland Shanks.
I suppose we need, at least in my view, I mean, we can look at these real worst-case scenarios, and then we can just kind of write them off as worst-case scenarios. Just a real narrow instance comes to mind, however, that may add some realism to it. Claude, you said that people in villages, and I come from a village, one of the few village areas in Siri, Cook Inlet region at Tionic, and I also teach lots of students who come from the bush, and I get to talk to them about their experiences. I mean, I don't have the hearings kind of thing, but at least I have some contacts with people even also in farther distances than I am. The idea that they won't sell because they recognize that there is a income potential, or there's more things that other than just, you know, these values that fall out of the air, but real things in terms of hunting. Unfortunately, even with those kinds of interests that are hooked in with something that has value, that creates value, there's current examples that sales and alienation will occur even though there's value bound up in it. And I'm talking about limited entry permits, where you have a large number of limited entry permits that have value in them as of themselves. They have lots of cultural value in them also and importance to the local area. And I was talking to this one fellow, and I mean, I know particular instances myself, but what frequently would happen is that the elder family member who had, you know, worked fishing for a long period of time and knew that, and it sustained his 8 or 10 members of the family, he held on. But the one son who was the helper for a long period of time, and as young people will do, are interested in the GTO in the driveway or are interested in going somewhere, don't quite appreciate that distinction and figure that they can always be a helper for someone else and sell it, get the $100,000, and it's gone. So that even though there are clear values represented by this thing that doesn't hook directly in, you know, it's not, you don't actually, a person doesn't really just come and pick the land up. This thing is associated with the right to fish and to make income and earnings off of it. They still sell, even knowing that. So there is the possibility of distinct populations, you know, young men or younger people, perhaps, who haven't established all the contacts and more than that, but have some kind of a dependency on it. There's the possibility that they're going to sell.
Yes, the subject of limited entry has come up at many meetings in coastal villages, and people have actually brought it up and said, people in this village have sold their limited entry permits, and if they're willing to sell those, then it'll come a lot easier to sell their shares. That point has been people have openly spoken of it. I think, Gary, you're next.
I don't think it's an either-or situation. I think that you have to deal with statistical probabilities. It appears that from the evidence that I've seen, a fair number of people with good reasons are going to be inclined to sell their shares. And I think that if you look at the motivations for that, there are some underlying problems that need to be addressed that deal with the stability of the corporation and with profitability. What I'm tempted to say here is that the survival of the corporation and the maintenance of the land base is tied with economic development. It's tied with where the state is, and it's tied with the condition of Native people in urban areas and in bush areas. I think that as we go through this time period that we're referring to, we see major changes occurring. We're going to see economic development opportunities either being constrained or enhanced in certain regions. I have just recently conducted a survey of five major economic sectors in the state. And in most cases, I think we're being overly optimistic whenever we profile the attractiveness of regional corporation takeovers, simply because a lot of those industries and a lot of those sectors are facing commodity cycle pricing that makes that corporation very it makes it difficult to strategize long-term plans. So in areas where there will be resource development in renewable resource areas in timber and fish, and in non-renewable areas in mining, I think there are probabilities that those corporations' stock will be valued and will be prized by outside entities. And along this line, I think that I would like to raise the question, if in fact there are a certain proportion of people that are interested in selling their stock because of some dissatisfaction with the way the corporation is performed, is it not then reasonable to begin looking at those motivations and trying to make some policy determination about what can be done to change those shareholder attitudes? I think one of the purposes of these meetings has been to increase the awareness of Native people in Alaska about the importance of 1991. And there have been many corporations that have made efforts to promote shareholder understanding of all the complexities. But even with these efforts, you still have a fairly large number of people that are relatively unaware of what can happen and what they can realistically expect from the corporation over time. One additional point that I would raise is that I think that the time frame, 2011, is a very long run, and I agree with John's worst case scenario. If in fact no changes are made, and if we see sort of many of the negative implications of this this scenario taking place, I'd say that they'd probably take place much sooner. And in fact, I think that there is a fair amount of circumstantial evidence to show that that is taking place in terms of the viability of village corporations. And what I'm getting to here is something that was talked about or mentioned earlier on with regard to a statewide native corporation, development corporation, that would try to not only blend the interests of the regions, but to develop plans and support projects that would be beneficial to the Alaska Native community. And in that regard, I've heard very little about any sort of systemic planning or any of the types of cooperative plans that would promote a more viable development pattern. We've talked a little bit about individual values and the sense of competition and profit that's implicit in the corporate world. Well, you see that evidenced in the competitiveness of regional corporations. At one time, not too long ago, at least 60% of the hotel rooms in the state were owned by Native corporations. Many of the economic activities that are related to supporting the oil economy of the state show that Native corporations compete against each other. And if we're talking about competitiveness and competitive values, one of the ways of perhaps overcoming that would be to look towards cooperative projects that would attempt to support development programs that would maintain a minimum level of livelihood for people that are going to make the decision to remain in the rural parts of the state. And I think that, that's a very important consideration. In other words, if in fact that one of the principal goals of these proposed resolutions is to maintain Native ownership of the land, then the question that follows is, how are those people out there going to live? Are they going to continue to draw their livelihood from subsistence activities or some combination of subsistence and wage economy?